newfound interest in the Psalms, a very large part of the enterprise, perhaps an inordinate amount of the enterprise, has flowed toward unfamiliar or novel approaches to the Psalms, chanting the Psalms, praying the Psalms in corporate worship, singing the Psalms, ensconcing the Psalms so thoroughly in Old Testament temple worship that you may have begun to feel guilty about reading the Psalms as a private individual. I stand before you as an advocate of something decidedly prosaic. You, as an individual, reading a psalm by yourself for devotional purposes. I also stand before you as a literary scholar who would like to see you read and meditate on an individual psalm as you have been encouraged to read and analyze a poem in your English classes. The Psalms as lyric poems? Yes. How does that fit into your semester-long emphasis on the Psalms in worship? To read and meditate on the Psalms as lyric poems belongs to the domain of private worship. I want you not to end up in the position of Nicodemus, of whom Jesus asked the pointed question, "Are you a teacher in Israel and yet do not know this?" Nicodemus was a stranger to what was best in his own tradition. The primary use to which the Psalms are put in evangelical Christendom is the reading of them by individual Christians. The number of you who will chant the Psalms in a monastery is statistically insignificant. The number of you who will sing the Psalms at the temple in Jerusalem is zero. The number of you who will read the Psalms for personal devotions is nearly 100%. So my subject this morning is the Psalms as lyric poems for private worship. I think that there is something new for you in this, namely the literary angle that I am urging upon you. Let me just demystify the term lyric. A lyric is a short poem. That will almost suffice as a definition. Additionally, a lyric expresses the thoughts or feelings of the poet, often stated directly in the first-person pronoun I, or we. Basically, what we call a poem is a lyric poem. As an epigraph for my venture, I have chosen the following statement from C.S. Lewis in the introduction to his book, Reflections on the Psalms. Quote, "Most emphatically, the Psalms must be read as poems, as lyrics, with all the licenses and all the formalities, the hyperboles, the emotional rather than logical connections which are proper to lyric poetry. They must be read as poems if they are to be understood." Are the Psalms lyric poems? Yes, they are demonstrably lyric poems. That is not up for grabs. The question is whether we are going to do anything with the fact that they are lyric poems. I propose that we do a lot with the lyric and poetic nature of the Psalms. I want to ease into this subject by asserting 10 preliminary things that I share with my audiences when I conduct workshops on the poetry of the Bible. 1, poems do not ordinarily tell a story. In literary circles at the present time, narrative is given an unwarranted prominence until everything literary is finally made to fit a narrative mold. Well, narrative comprises only half of the realms of gold that we call literature, and lyric poetry is not a province in the realm of narrative. Poetry is a province all by itself. So my advice is, don't try to make a psalm tell a story if it doesn't. 2, poems are not prose essays. They do not have a thesis to prove, the way an essay does. The practical implication, do not force a psalm into the mold of an essay with a thesis and supporting arguments. It won't work well. I'm not saying it won't work at all. It simply won't work well. 3, positively, in their content, lyric poems are either A, meditative or reflective, or B, emotional or affective. In a reflective psalm, the poet shares a series of thoughts on a subject. In an affective lyric, the poet shares a series of feelings, or at least gives us material that evokes feelings in us. 4, the structure of a poem is frequently disjointed. more so with the Psalms than with the poetry that I teach in English courses day by day. 5, poetry is written in verse form, and in the Bible, a single verse form, known as parallelism, saying something more than once with different words and images, but in similar grammatical form. We need to assimilate verse in ways that are different from how we assimilate prose. The rhythm of thought in verse is line by line. In prose, it is sentence by sentence. 6, most emphatically, poets think in images and concretions rather than abstractions. The image, broadly defined as any word naming an action or thing, is the basic building block of poetry. If poets think in images, so must we as readers. 7, poets prefer the figurative to the literal. They are always playing the game of make-believe, asking us to accept something that we know is not literally true. Their teeth are spears and arrows, their tongues sharp swords. You, God, are my fortress. The meadows clothe themselves with flocks. It is entirely accurate for us to speak of poetic license. So please, we should not say regarding the Psalms that we interpret them literally. 8, figures of speech require interpretation. Figures of speech require interpretation. He is like a tree planted by streams of water. When the poet puts that simile before us, it is up to us to figure out how a godly person is like a tree. It is inappropriate to say, I just want to read the Psalms, don't ask me to analyze them. Let me assert the point again. Figurative language requires interpretation. If we refuse to interpret, we have declined the invitation of the psalmist to discover his intended meanings. I want to make sure that I have fully registered that point. A psalm is the poet's invitation to us to discover his meanings. A psalm is the poet's invitation to us to discover his meanings. 9, poetry is a way of thinking before it is a form of discourse. Poets compose poems because they think that way. What is that way? You be the judge, based on the following. The Westminster Confession of Faith defines providence this way. God, the creator of all things, doth uphold, direct, dispose, and govern all creatures, actions, and things, from the greatest even to the least, by his most wise and holy providence. That's how the abstract intellect thinks. In Psalm 23, the poet presents providence in terms of the daily routine of a shepherd. That's how the imagination thinks. 10, a lyric poem is not a delivery system for an idea. A lyric poem exists to prompt us to meditation or reflection or emotional or affective response. I want to kidnap a comment that a biblical scholar made about Jesus' parables. A psalm is not a delivery system for an idea. Instead, it is a house in which the reader is invited to take up residence, and out of which the reader looks at life. In our circles, the tendency is overwhelming to reduce a psalm to a set of ideas. I have a colleague who made a survey of Bible study guides to the Psalms. He found that virtually all of the guides pay very little attention to the images of the Psalms, and instead extract ideas from the text and then quickly move to application. Having laid the foregoing foundation, I want to spend the rest of my time developing 3 points as follows. 1, the Psalms and the emotional life. 2, the absolute need to interact with the surface texture of the Psalms and not leapfrog over that texture in our quest to find the ideas that are expressed in a psalm. 3, Psalm 23 as a test case. First then, the emotional or affective side of the Psalms when we read them as lyric poems in private worship. I propose that the whole lyric enterprise is based on the premise that the poet is our representative, saying what we once said, only saying it better. So we should let the psalmist be our spokespersons, and we should own their statements as ours. Surely it is a common experience for us to find that the Psalms furnish words and express sentiments that we ourselves want to say, but lack the resources to express. The Psalms give us forms for our feelings. Forms for our feelings. If the sentiments and feelings that the psalmist expresses are normative for us in this way, I suggest that we can read the Psalms as strengthening and correcting our own feelings and attitudes. John Milton claimed that one of the functions of poetry is to set the affections in right tune. The Psalms can set our affections in right tune. The English poet William Wordsworth said that a great poet ought to rectify people's feelings, to give them new compositions of feeling. Rectify people's feelings, give them new compositions of feeling. English poet Percy Shelley claimed that great poetry, quote, strengthens and purifies the affections. The Psalms can do it for us. My next main point, we should not leapfrog over the poetic texture of a psalm, the images and figures of speech, in order to get to its ideas. In any discourse, meaning is communicated through form, starting with words themselves. The form of poetry is images and figures of speech. The flood sweeps over me. I lie down amid fiery beasts. Wickedness shuts its mouth. If the psalmist had wanted us to deal in abstractions, surely they would not have spoken in images and metaphors. Last spring, I attended a professional meeting on hymnody in which someone with a PhD in musicology surveyed what the Bible tells us about hymns in the church. The speaker's outline for the Song of Moses was this: a song of deliverance, God's judgment, God's works and ways, fulfillment of God's word, God's attributes, greatness, power, justice, truth, holiness, righteousness. How could someone with artistic intuitions see only abstractions and say nothing about the actual texture of the poem? Nothing about those glorious images of the blast of God's nostrils, the waters piled up, the horse and his rider thrown into the sea. How could this happen? It's not hard to figure that out. We all handle the Bible in keeping with the models that we have been provided. And the dominant model for dealing with the Bible is to turn it into theological abstractions. So what I am proposing this morning is that we need a partial shift, not a wholesale revolt, in the paradigm with which we experience and talk about the Psalms. Now, while I could continue to give you more good theory about the Psalms as lyric poems for private worship, I think I owe it to you to sketch out what I myself do with a psalm along the lines of what I am proposing that you yourself do. For four decades, Psalm 23 has been, for me, the supreme lyric of the world, and I want to reach way back to the origins of this feeling. My first literary encounter with Psalm 23 came as a teenager in our Iowa farmhouse, while I perused a copy of Reader's Digest. The encounter came in the form of an article entitled The Basque Sheepherder and the Shepherd Psalm, a piece so popular that it was not only printed at least twice in Reader's Digest, but was also made available in bulk as a freestanding reprint. In case you are not holding onto your seat in disbelief, let me add that in looking at this reprint from my still bounteous supply while composing this address, I myself was astonished to learn that the article originally appeared in a publication called The National Wool Grower. Are you tracking with me? From our farmhouse, let me fast forward to the end of my graduate education in Eugene, Oregon. The pastor of the small home mission church that I had attended for 4 years had to be gone of a Sunday, so he entrusted the adult Sunday school class to me. I cannot reconstruct the logic that lay behind my choice of an explication of Psalm 23, but I can say unequivocally that my career as a literary critic of the Bible, and in fact my devotion to the integration of literature and the Christian faith, can be traced right back to this humble church assignment. I threw myself into the venture with such zest that the assignment actually sprawled to two class sessions. Unlikely as it might seem, I was able to ferret out a copy of the Reader's Digest article in the University of Oregon Library. What did I get from the Basque Shepherd's interpretation of Psalm 23 that still strikes me as a literary understanding of the psalm? What the Basque Shepherd did was uncover the literal references to a shepherd's experience with sheep in the ancient Near East. So this leads me to state the first principle that undergirds my literary analysis of Psalm 23. The subject of literature is recognizable human experience, concretely presented. I believe that a literary text first of all asks us to relive an experience that the author puts before us. What wins me with the Basque Shepherd on Psalm 23 is the way in which he uncovers the richness of real life experience in the psalm. Let me also toss into the mix a formula that C.S. Lewis championed and that has been a linchpin for my own teaching of literature. Lewis claimed that when we read a work of literature, we should first of all pay attention to, quote, the central obvious appeal of a great work. The central obvious appeal of a great work. The context in which the statement occurs is Lewis's criticism of the 16th century humanists who could, quote, not really bring themselves to believe that the poet cared about the shepherds, lovers, warriors, voyages, and battles of medieval romances. They must only be a disguise for something more adult. All right, what is the central obvious appeal of Psalm 23? My answer, it's evocation of a shepherd's life and world with their scenes of green pastures and still waters, a shepherd's leading his sheep on safe paths, acts of protection in dark valleys where predators lurk, and provision in the sheepfold at the end of the day. Point number one, Psalm 23 takes its basic stuff straight from the everyday world of sheep and shepherds, and this is not extraneous to our experience of the poem, but central to it. Secondly, to make adequate sense of Psalm 23, we need to experience it in terms of its literary genre, its type or kind. Within the general framework of lyric, Psalm 23 is most obviously a pastoral poem. That is, its frame of reference is the world of sheep and shepherds and landscapes and activities that pertain to that world. More specifically, I believe that Psalm 23 fits into a very old pastoral genre known as the ideal pastoral day. Works that fall into this genre trace in loving detail the activities that a shepherd performs during the course of a typical day. I believe that Psalm 23 traces an entire day in the life of a shepherd. The poem opens with the sheep resting in lush surroundings at midday, with the comment, "He restores my life," or "He revitalizes me," serving as a summary of the event with which the poem opens. Even though the poem begins at midday, there are implied references to earlier movement from the sheepfold to morning grazing and drinking. The picture of the shepherds leading the sheep on right paths evokes the picture of daily movement of the sheep through a treacherous terrain, and later references to a dark valley and a rod and staff reinforce the picture of the sheep's journey between sheepfold and places of feeding and watering. I embrace the minority viewpoint, but it is a respectable and sizable minority, that the prepared table refers to strips of grass, that the enemies are either predators or poisonous plants, that the anointed head and overflowing cup refer to the shepherd's actions in the sheepfold at the end of the day, and that the metaphoric house to which the sheep return is the sheepfold. Now, I realize that my emphasis on the mundane and human element in Psalm 23 may seem trivial to a theologically minded interpreter, but I'm going to have the courage of my convictions in asserting that we need to let a literary text be a literary text before we become preoccupied with its religious ideas. In particular, we need to resist the common practice of quickly reducing a text to an idea. Additionally, literary meaning is communicated through form, with the result that we cannot speak of the meaning of a literary text without first interacting with the form. The primary form of Psalm 23 is metaphor, and a literary approach takes that form seriously. The most important thing about a metaphor is that it is a bifocal form of discourse. It first paints a picture at a literal level, and then requires us to carry over the meaning from level A to level B, with the latter being the actual subject of the poem. The word metaphor is based on two Greek words meaning meta, the two Greek words meaning meta and pherein, which when combined yield the meaning to carry over. Before we make the transfer of meaning, we need to experience level A. And at this point, what I said earlier about sheep and shepherds reinforces what I am saying here. Let me unpack selected metaphors in Psalm 23 to illustrate the point. "The Lord is my shepherd," the poem begins, thereby introducing the controlling metaphor for the entire poem. The human meanings of the metaphor are the same as the pastoral meanings. Both the shepherd and God serve the roles as provider, guide, protector, and healer. Additionally, the opening assertion that God is a shepherd depends on our getting the ancient picture of shepherding clear. We are not dealing with fenced pastures and watering troughs, but with a situation in which the sheep are totally dependent on the shepherd for all aspects of their physical sustenance. The next metaphor that requires unpacking is the picture of the sheep resting at midday after grazing and watering in the morning. If that is literal level A of the metaphor, what human meanings emerge when we carry over the meaning to a human level? Well, the key motif is bringing back to a previous condition, and I am prepared to see physical, psychological, emotional, and spiritual versions of restoration in the metaphor. He leads me in right paths, the poet says metaphorically. What are the right paths in which God leads me that emerge from the picture of sheep led in safe paths? For me, the list keeps expanding. God's moral law, or the Bible, the indwelling presence of the Holy Spirit, the example and teachings of Christ, admonitions and the godly example of spouses or parents or fellow Christians, conscience. A literary text does justice to the multiplicity of real life, and literary critics revel in that multiplicity, sometimes to excess, I will admit. Even though I walk through the valley of deepest darkness, writes the poet, about the journey of the sheep through the place of greatest fear and danger. If you were to illustrate the carryover of that metaphor to a human level by means of a slideshow, what scenes would you choose? My slideshow includes pictures of death, accident, the wild, the unexpected bill, destruction of a house, moral temptation, sinning, financial collapse, physical and mental illness, and such like, the dark valleys of life. By means of a single evocative metaphor, the poet taps into an ever-expanding picture of the dark valleys of our own lives. Where do the ideas of Psalm 23 enter a literary analysis of it? My answer is late in the process. The problem with traditional approaches to the Bible, in my view, lies in the unstated assumption that biblical texts are delivery systems for ideas. As a result, the ideational content of a text preempts a literary analysis of it. The text is usually dipped into in support of generalizations. If the ideas were the most important thing, the author would have stated them as ideas. I am reminded of the French poet Mallarmé's reply to a poet who lamented his inability to write poetry, even though he was, quote, full of ideas. Mallarmé's reply was, "One does not make poetry with ideas." The first task of a reader or interpreter is to relive the text as fully as possible. Relive the text as fully as possible, vicariously living through the experience that the text puts before us and following the path that the writer lays down, including the artistic properties of a text. Part of what the poet of Psalm 23 put into the poem is an idea. Nothing I have said should be allowed to obscure that Psalm 23 embodies a theme. I agree with poet Denise Levertov's retort to the motto of modern poets, "No ideas but in things." Levertov's retort was, "No ideas but in things" does not mean no ideas. The big idea that Psalm 23 asserts is the sufficiency of God's providence in the life of people who follow God and depend on Him. Just as the shepherd's provision for his sheep extends to all of their needs, so too with God's provision for us. Here is a one-sentence summary of this chapel address. The Psalms are lyric poems that obey the ordinary rules of lyric poetry about which we learn in English courses. And whatever other use we make of such poems, we should at least read and ponder them in our private devotional worship. Amen.